Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Hey, our special guest this week is Harold Kramer, WJ1B. Now, he's the COO of the American Radio Relay League. He's got all kinds of things to talk about today. Our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH, is joining us. And a word of warning, for some reason on this show, we had some problems with audio. So if you hear a little distortion or little things that don't quite sound right, that's what it is. But I think we get it corrected about maybe one-third of the way through the show. Once again, Harold Kramer, WJ1B, our special guest, the COO of the American Radio Relay League on QSO. Coming to you from the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen, this is QSO Live. And with us tonight, we have our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH. And all I have to do is say this. I'll watch this now, how easy this is. Say hello, Frank.
Hello, Frank.
And I understand you're in some inclement weather down there.
I think it's passing. Radar and my NOAA training of being an official storm spotter says that cell has moved beyond us, and I hope it stays up high in the air.
There you go. And with us tonight, we're very honored to have Harold Kramer with us, WJ1B. And, of course, he is is that the COO? Am I getting this right? Of the ARRL?
A lot of initials, but that's correct.
Oh, there you go.
And Chief Operating Officer. Right.
Yeah, I get confused with all these terms. I just do. But you know what? You don't get confused if you run in and meet and speak to Harold. We've seen and talked to each other. He's been on the air with us before from Dayton. And my goodness, I not to talk in front of your back, but what a nice guy. I was so impressed when he would sit down and talk with us at Dayton and discuss all kinds of things about amateur radio, about the ARRL, and so on and so forth. So really honored to have him here tonight. And he's a very busy fella. He's hard to get pinned down, you know, because he's got so many things going on. And I don't even know where to start. But one of the things that I did want to do is I did want to open it wide open and say, Harold, if there are things that you'd like to talk about, things you'd like to mention or I guess I want to say promote or bring to light, just jump right in and feel free. The airtime is yours.
Oh, well, thanks, Ted. And my pleasure. And I do remember that interview with Dayton. That was really a great interview, I thought.
Well, we had we talked about everything under the sun, as they say. Yeah. In the South, we talked the hind legs off the mule.
I haven't heard that. I'm sitting up here in Connecticut.
You've heard that, haven't you, Frank?
Oh, you bet. In fact, we had a mule when I was a child, so you bet.
Well, Frank, start off with asking questions that are on your mind and also find out here. We're going to find out what's on Harold's mind, what he wants to talk about tonight.
Oh, great. That sounds good. One little thing about Harold, and this works well for politicians and preachers, but it also works well for a national organization whose chief operating officer meets someone once, and they remember that person's name. And Harold remembered mine, and that always makes an impression on anyone, Harold. So that's a perfect characteristic to have for someone in your role. Just as an acid test, just to help Ted out. Chief Operating Officer versus Chief Executive Officer. The COO has to be there when the business opens, right? But the CEO may not have to.
Right.
There you go.
See, Ted, also, that's the difference. I say the COO makes sure the trains arrive at the station on time.
I also want to mention our co-engineer here, and my son David is here, KG4WXW. And he's of the younger ilk, so he may come up with some questions that us older guys won't think about. So we want to say hello to Harold there, David.
Good evening, everyone, and hello, Mr. Harold.
And Frank, of course.
And Frank.
Hi, David. Man. How are you?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our special guest, Harold Kramer, WJ1B, right after this. Now, the last thing you want to do is run out of shopping days before Christmas. There's no need to do that. All you got to do is go to one website. That's R&L Electronics. If you're thinking ham radio, you're buying for a ham or buying for yourself at Christmas time, why not? R&L Electronics. Now listen, go to their website and look at what they've got. Talk about ideas. They've got towers, radio accessories. They have HF radios, VHF radios, UHF radios. They've got power supplies. They've got connectors. They've got coax and cable. They've got books on amateur radio. They've got amateur radio tuners, antenna tuners, I should say, automatic and manual. They've got antenna mounts. They've got all sorts of antenna accessories, along with antennas themselves. And they also have big amplifiers, and they have medium-sized amplifiers, and they've got preamps, and they've got used equipment, and they've got all the major brand names like Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Alinco, you name it. It's all there at R&L Electronics. Now, another thing, they carry used items, radios that have been previously owned that are in mint condition. And they have free shipping on used items until 12/18. So you've got until the 18th for free shipping on any of the used items. They've got the new Yaesu System Fusion Mobile on sale right now for $309.95 and free shipping. I won't mention very many more prices, but let me just say this. They've got a dual band mobile right now for $99.95. Can you believe that? Their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. Now, I'll give that to you in just a minute. But just remember, folks are happy when they deal with R&L Electronics. They're great on service. They're courteous. They get the item out quickly to you. And if you have any problems at all, these folks are right on top of it. Now, once again, their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. 1-800-221-7735. Or go to Google and just Google R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. And mention WTWW when you call. Let me tell you about one item that's really cool. And it's a small FM radio transmitter. And what you can do with this thing is you can plug it into an MP3 player. You can plug it into your computer, your television set. If you play guitar, you can plug your guitar into it. Portable DVD players, your iPod. You can take your iPod with you in the car, plug it into this FM transmitter, and tune it in on your car radio. I mean, it's just all kind of things. But what I was thinking about is all of our ham buddies and ham friends. What about if you plug it into the ham rig? Then you can have FM radios on all over the house and backyard and everywhere, and you can listen to your favorite frequency, or even better yet, if you tune in WTWW, you can have it coming in every radio on the house. And then some. Maybe the neighbors. You never know. You've got to see this thing. This is called the Digital FM Transmitter 2. And you just go up to the website and take a look at this thing. It's cute. I mean, it's little. It's great for in the car, because if you got something that you want to plug in and listen to on your car radio, you can do it. If your car doesn't have one of those inputs, or you don't have cassette in the car. That's a kind of an awkward period of time for car radios, where everybody's gone to CD, there's no cassettes, and there's no input. So this is where the Digital FM Transmitter 2 from Sea Crane really shines. Yeah, I mean, it's little. Slip in your pocket, and you can take it over to your neighbor's house and jam an FM station that you don't like. Just kidding. But for the ham, I think this is really super cool, because this thing can be plugged into a ham rig and every radio in the house becomes a speaker system for you. Anyhow, we want you to go up to the Sea Crane website and take a look at this. And, of course, you know it's seacrane.com. And the phone number to call is 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And please mention WTWW when you call. And thank those folks for bringing you the Art Bell Show. Once again, The phone number is 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863. Here we are at WTWW, and we're doing it again at Christmas time. It's Christmas music. We love to play Christmas music at Christmas time on shortwave radio. And what's really cool is when you folks blow the dust off those classic radios and get them out of the closet and get them under the Christmas tree and beside the Christmas tree, and you decorate them up and you tune us in and you listen to the Christmas music on those classic radios. There isn't anything like it. Last year, we ran a promotion. We asked you folks to send in pictures of your classic radios. We're doing it again this year. The grand prize for the winner is from Trans World Antennas, and it's the TW2010 antenna. I mean, this one's decked out. It's got the carry bag with it. It's got the Quadra stand. If you go up to their website and look at twantennas.com or transworldantennas.com and look up the TW2010, you'll see what I'm talking about. But snap a picture of that classic radio. Dress it up. Make a video. Send us a video. Send us a snapshot. Hey, get some pictures of the family near the radio. We want to see people in these pictures, too. That is so cool. And last year, you folks outdone yourself. Well, this year, we're prepared for it because there's going to be prizes, and we're going to have the pictures up on the website. And we just thank you so much for tuning us in and helping us celebrate the season with Christmas music on shortwave radio. Now, once you snap a picture of that classic radio, you want to send it to email at WTWW.us. That's email at WTWW.us. And if you want to send it to us snail mail, you can do that as well. It's WTWW, Post Office Box 102, Lebanon, Tennessee, 37088. That's WTWW, Post Office Box 102, Lebanon, Tennessee, 37088. We'll be giving those addresses, the email address as well as the snail mail address, out again throughout the entire season. So just keep it tuned and enjoy the Christmas music on WTWW. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now, back to our special guest, the COO of the American Radio Relay League, Harold Kramer, WJ1B.
Listen, Harold, let's kick this off. This is an exciting time for the American Radio Relay League. And I will say, in full disclosure, I spent about 5 years as what I described to Ted as being a volunteer flunky for the Delta Division. Pay was low, but the work was moderate, but it was thoroughly enjoyable. And I recently pulled back from that when I took on some club duties as vice president for programming. That means, Harold, I have to get a speaker every month to make sure all the AV equipment's working and all that good stuff. And also, when Ted asked me to come on as co-host of this very fine program with a great history, I jumped at the chance. I began in commercial broadcasting in FM and then AM back in my early 20s. Exciting time for the league for many reasons. One, there's going to be a change in the CEO spot. Dave Sumner is formally announced his retirement. There's, I guess, a search process going on, and I think there are maybe resumes being solicited and those kind of things. And there is a real rumor going on that you may be penciling up something on your calendar. Is that true?
Yes, that is true.
See, when you take the top two people out of an organization, Ted, that's like taking the final tube. You know, you got a lot of stuff going on, but it really doesn't get out of the transmitter unless you put that tube back in, or those tubes back in. So that in itself will be a big change for the league. It's also an important time for the league because of the demographics of change, as the so-called graying of amateur radio and things like that. Ted and I have had the pleasure of interviewing Anna Veal, the Young Ham of the Year, recently, and I think we came away with the clear sense that amateur radio in the future is going to take care of itself with young hams like Anna. So tell us a little bit about the change at the top, just to kind of kick things off. Where is that search process at? Are you getting any interest that you, I mean, just in terms of people interested in following someone whose shoes are big enough to fit on the hind leg of that mule that Ted was talking about? Because Dave's been there for quite some time.
40 years.
That's about as long as a good pair of horseshoes would last. You know, they're made out of steel. So tell us a little bit about the change that's coming up.
Dave has announced that he's going to retire in May. I am also going to retire, I believe, sometime around the first quarter. But I am remaining, and I have told our board that I'm going to remain a little flexible so that we have a good transition. And I'm sure Dave will, too. There is a CEO search committee of the ARRL board. Jim Pace, whose call sign I can't pull off the top of my head. See, Frank, not only in ham radio do you have to know names, but you have to know call signs.
Exactly.
And if you don't talk to him on the air often, you can't remember the call sign.
Except for Dave Sumner, who can remember call signs incredibly well. But so Jim Pace, who is our Northwest Division Director, he is K7CEX. Jim is the chairman of the search committee. I am not privy to any of their deliberations. They are doing it, keeping things quite confidential. Because amateur radio, you know, is a pretty small community. But they have been working very diligently, as Frank said, gathering up resumes. And I know they've been interviewing some candidates, but I really do not know the status of their search.
When do they project? Or, and these things are fairly fluid. We've probably all been involved with selection processes. But what's a kind of a target time cycle?
I believe they would like to have a candidate or the top couple of candidates meet everyone at the January board meeting.
Okay. So
that's
so
the way January it worked when I was hired, actually. I did not I could not get out of my previous position at Connecticut Public Broadcasting until February, but they invited me to the January board meeting because the ARL full board only meets twice a year, January and July, and I met all of the board members. If not, I would have had to wait till July to meet them all.
Right.
So that's the current thinking, and that's probably about all I know about the process at the moment.
Sure.
I believe the thinking is, and as you said, Frank, it's kind of fluid. The thinking is not to hire a COO until a new CEO is in place, and let him or her hire their own second in command.
You bet.
Which makes sense.
Certainly.
It's always nice to have the synergy of a person that you know, or at least you know their attributes, to be able to pick, because you know that you can work synergistically with them.
That's right. And complementary skill sets. You want to hire the same set of skills twice.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our special guest, Harold Kramer, WJ1B, right after this. Now, the last thing you want to do is run out of shopping days before Christmas. There's no need to do that. All you got to do is go to one website. That's R&L Electronics. If you're thinking ham radio, you're buying for a ham or buying for yourself at Christmas time? Why not? R&L Electronics. Now listen, go to their website and look at what they've got. Talk about ideas. They've got towers, radio accessories. They have HF radios, VHF radios, UHF radios. They've got power supplies. They've got connectors. They've got coax and cable. They've got books on amateur radio. They've got amateur radio tuners, antenna tuners, I should say, automatic and manual. They've got antenna mounts. They've got all sorts of antenna accessories, along with antennas themselves. And they also have big amplifiers, and they have medium-sized amplifiers. and they've got preamps, and they've got used equipment, and they've got all the major brand names like Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Alinco, you name it. It's all there at R&L Electronics. Now, another thing, they carry used items. Radios that have been previously owned that are in mint condition, and they have free shipping on used items until 12/18. So you've got until the 18th for free shipping on any of the used items. They've got the new Yaesu System Fusion Mobile on sale right now for $309.95 and free shipping. I won't mention very many more prices, but let me just say this. They've got a dual band mobile right now for $99.95. Can you believe that? Their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. Now, I'll give that to you in just a minute. But just remember, folks are happy when they deal with R&L Electronics. They're great on service. They're courteous. They get the item out quickly to you. And if you have any problems at all, these folks are right on top of it. Now, once again, their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. 1-800-221-7735. Or go to Google and just Google R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. And mention WTWW when you call. Let me tell you about one item that's really cool. And it's a small FM radio transmitter. And what you can do with this thing is you can plug it into an MP3 player. You can plug it into your computer, your television set. If you play guitar, you can plug your guitar into it. Portable DVD players, your iPod. You can take your iPod with you in the car, plug it into this FM transmitter, and tune it in on your car radio. I mean, it's just all kind of things. But what I was thinking about is all of our ham buddies and ham friends. What about if you plug it into the ham rig? Then you can have FM radios on all over the house and backyard and everywhere, and you can listen to your favorite frequency, or even better yet, if you tune in WTWW, you can have it coming in every radio on the house. And then some. Maybe the neighbors. You never know. You've got to see this thing. This is called the Digital FM Transmitter 2. And you just go up to the website and take a look at this thing. It's cute. I mean, it's little. It's great for in the car, because if you got something that you want to plug in and listen to on your car radio, you can do it. If your car doesn't have one of those inputs, or you don't have cassette in the car. That's a kind of an awkward period of time for car radios, where everybody's gone to CD, there's no cassettes, and there's no input. So this is where the Digital FM Transmitter 2 from Sea Crane really shines. Yeah, I mean, it's little. Slip in your pocket, and you can take it over to your neighbor's house and jam an FM station that you don't like. Just kidding. But for the ham, I think this is really super cool, because this thing can be plugged into a ham rig and every radio in the house becomes a speaker system for you. Anyhow, we want you to go up to the Sea Crane website and take a look at this. And, of course, you know it's seacrane.com. And the phone number to call is 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And please mention WTWW when you call. And thank those folks for bringing you the Art Bell Show. Once again, the phone number is 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, theunseenbean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com.
Now, don't be frustrated with Wi-Fi. That's one of the most frustrating things I think you can face when you open up your notebook and you're getting ready to do something and the Wi-Fi's flaky. You know, it goes and comes. It doesn't seem to matter where you position your notebook. It just won't happen. Well, you can solve that problem and turn Wi-Fi reception into a pleasure if you get the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3 from the C-Crane Company. Now, that's right. It significantly boosts your Wi-Fi internet signal. Significantly. And the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna from C-Crane will help improve the entire Wi-Fi picture for your computer or laptop. Now, this thing can detect a Wi-Fi hotspot hundreds of feet away. It can boost the internet signal to keep your connection strong. It's made for indoor or outdoor use. It's water resistant. It can be mounted up high for best reception. I mean, like up on the roof. It plugs into a computer or a laptop via the USB port. So you're not messing around with little connectors and things like that. It's easy to install the software that comes with it, and it's an experience. It will change your Wi-Fi experience forever. Now, to order the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3, call C-Crane now at 1-800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863. Or visit them at ccrane.com. Now, mention WTWW, and we ask that you do, because that keeps the Art Bell Show on shortwave. If you love Art on shortwave, then place an order with C-Crane. Let Bob Crane know that you're patronizing their great company. Once again, boost your Wi-Fi signal. Get rid of your Wi-Fi frustration with the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3 from C-Crane. Now, those phone numbers, once again, 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And mention WTWW. Here we are at WTWW, and we're doing it again at Christmas time. It's Christmas music. We love to play Christmas music at Christmas time on shortwave radio. And what's really cool is when you folks blow the dust off those classic radios and get them out of the closet and get them under the Christmas tree and beside the Christmas tree, and you decorate them up and you tune us in and you listen to the Christmas music on those classic radios. There isn't anything like it. Last year, we ran a promotion. We asked you folks to send in pictures of your classic radios. We're doing it again this year. The grand prize for the winner is from Trans World Antennas, and it's the TW2010 antenna. I mean, this one's decked out. It's got the carry bag with it. It's got the quadra stand. If you go up to their website and look at twantennas.com or transworldantennas.com and look up the TW2010, you'll see what I'm talking about. But snap a picture of that classic radio. Dress it up. Make a video. Send us a video. Send us a snapshot. Hey, get some pictures of the family near the radio. We want to see people in these pictures, too. That is so cool. And last year, you folks outdone yourself. Well, this year, we're prepared for it because there's going to be prizes, and we're going to have the pictures up on the website. And we just thank you so much for tuning us in and helping us celebrate the season with Christmas music on shortwave radio. Now, once you snap a picture of that classic radio, you want to send it to email at WTWW.us. That's email at WTWW.us. And if you want to send it to us snail mail, you can do that as well. It's WTWW, Post Office Box 102, Lebanon, Tennessee, 37088. That's WTWW, Post Office Box 102, Lebanon, Tennessee, 37088. We'll be giving those addresses, the email address as well as the snail mail address, out again throughout the entire season. So just keep it tuned and enjoy the Christmas music on WTWW. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now, back to our special guest, the COO of the American Radio Relay League, Harold Kramer, WJ1B.
So the ARL, you know, is a large organization. It's a very decentralized organization, even though people think about the headquarters, you know, as the organization. I would offer it's really not. There's really more people who are part and parcel of that organization away from Newington. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. That's one of the things that surprised me years ago when I was hired, how sort of decentralized it was. I mean, the board members, the 15 directors and the 15 vice directors come from all over the country. And there are also 71 section managers who come from all over the country. And we have about 7,500 leadership positions, like the one you were talking about, Frank, in the Delta right. Division. You know, the under the SM, there's SECs, the section emergency coordinators. There are emergency coordinators. There are official observers or club coordinators. So, you know, there's thousands of people out there. We have, you could tell them to see, oh, I could cite statistics. We have about 25,000 volunteer examiners.
Right.
All over the country and indeed all over the world. So a lot of the ARRL is not at 225 Main Street in Newington.
You know, and that's something that there's probably a great divide between hams that have great tenure, that is, regardless of their age, they've been a ham a long time or they've not been a ham a long time, is that the FCC has placed what I consider tremendous trust in the integrity of not only the ARL, but some other VE groups mm-hmm. when they got out of the official testing business. And that places, again, as we look at the news media and we see in the public school systems all kind of scandals about cheating on tests and teachers and principals upping the test scores. Why? Because they're evaluated and paid and fired and continued on but because of those. So in a sense, the ARL runs a grand examination process with a great deal of trust in the integrity of that process, as well as regulating the process of the examiners themselves. Not every ham really knows and appreciates that. We hear kind of the so-called old guard. When I drove to, in this neck of the woods, to New Orleans wow. to sit for my exam or to Atlanta, that's something that not every rank and file ham fully appreciates.
Yeah, we have a great volunteer exam coordinator department, and the head of it, Maria Soma, AB1FM, has been with that program really since its inception for 30 years now.
Well, and does she have a hammer? She needs to go over and tap that ULS computer a time or two to get it to start taking results.
Yeah it's stopped working again. We had the news story up on our website. It hasn't been working since Friday.
There are a lot of anxious people who want to hit the push to talk button, Harold.
You bet.
I want to jump in here real quick before we go too far down the other path, and then of course then I would be a major distraction by bringing this up. But Harold, you said something about Connecticut Public Broadcasting,
yes,
and that this is what you were doing prior to the league.
Yes.
I'd like for you to tell folks a little bit about what you did in the broadcasting arena.
Okay. Well, I was chief technology officer at Connecticut Public Broadcasting, and pretty much my responsibility there was conversion of analog to digital, not just technical, but what would happen with the other channels that would soon become available. Connecticut Public Broadcasting is television and radio. There's only one public broadcaster on television in Connecticut. And it's if you know about public broadcasting, it's a community licensee. Prior to that, pretty much most of my career was spent in the cable television industry. From when I graduated college to when I joined Connecticut Public Broadcasting in 2005, I had spent just about my entire career in cable television, from startup forward, which was an exciting thing to do. I started in cable before they had satellite dishes. So
I was going to say, you got to see all the major changes, all the technology, and every time I'm sure every day you woke up, there was something new sitting on your desk saying, well, we've got to implement this.
Yeah, ESPN is only about 15 minutes from here, and I was actually at the first meeting where ESPN was conceived. I made the book of history of ESPN as one of the participants in that discussion. So you're right, Ted. Every day was something new in that industry. But like a lot of people in cable, I sat sort of in the same chair for 17 years, but went through three sets of owners. And then I was recruited by the telephone company here in Connecticut to help them start a cable television system, which was called Americast at that time and now is morphed into Uvision. So the whole thing is was kind of hard to follow with all the different owners, but most of my career was cable television and broadcast television. The cable company I worked for also owned 18 radio stations.
It's so complex now, but I remember back during the time that if you wanted to get HBO, they simply came out to your house and screwed in a trap or a filter.
Filter, yeah.
And bing, there it was, you know.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Although a lot of hams figured out how to bypass the filter, you know.
Or how to build one, I guess.
Yeah. That was real emerging technology then.
You know, we see so much change in technology. It's just absolutely amazing. Now, of course, we have iBock Digital on FM, and look at where television has gone. And, you know, someone said something the other day. I heard murmurings of this, because I don't work in the television industry, that they're looking at another form of HD to take the resolution up even higher. And I'm thinking, my goodness, you know, it just isn't ever going to stop. But you know what's exciting is the fact that all these changes that have taken place in the broadcast industry have paralleled in the amateur radio field and the amateur radio hobby. The technology there has gotten to the point now where it's so vast that, my goodness, I don't know. Is it possible for one person to learn it all?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so either. And Dave Sumner and I have talked about that, and Dave and I both sort of said, you know, when we were younger, you couldn't know almost everything about amateur radio. You only had a couple of modes, right? At AMCW and RIDI with a teleprinter.
Now, wait a minute, guys. Have you been on 80 meters, 75 meter phone lately? There are people on there that know everything.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that's human nature, right?
Yeah, but Frank, we don't hang out on the frequencies that you're on.
And I'm just listening. I'm just listening while I'm editing. I use a lot of the web.
No, SCR, you'll have to understand. You have to understand, Harold. We jab each other back and forth on this show. It's a lot of fun to do that, you know. And
yeah. Oh, you bet. Yeah. I think in the industry they call that chemistry.
Is that what it is?
Okay.
Well, you know, I guess what I was saying is that you're sitting at the top of the heap. You get a chance to see everything that's going on. And I guess that to me would be so mind-boggling. Of course, I'm bad ADD. I couldn't do that. It would drive me crazy. There's so many things. And how do you wind up keeping up with all of it?
Well, an important thing is to have very knowledgeable people who work for you, who are specialists in all of these areas, because you cannot possibly know everything. So I'm lucky to have such a great staff. I mean, to work with people like Steve Ford, you know, who's written so many of our books and is so knowledgeable, particularly about digital modes, or people like Ed Hare, W1RFI, who runs our lab, who is so knowledgeable. Ed was in another IEEE meeting last week representing the ARRL. We just have a great staff. People like Maria in VEC, a guy like Dave Patton and N1N, who knows an incredible amount about DXing and awards and contesting. You're right. It's such a wide field now that one person cannot possibly know everything. So I think the real key, at least for me, is having great people working for me and with me who are really knowledgeable in these areas. it would be impossible.
I have not had a chance to meet a whole lot of the ARRL constituency, but people that come to mind, I look at somebody like Bob Allison, and he, you know,
sure.
You talk about a dedicated, committed fellow who is really just wrapped up in it. And they've all been like that. The folks I've met, I dealt for years with Alan Pitts and, just completely ate up with ham radio and the league and whatnot. You couldn't ask for more dedication, I guess.
No, I knew Alan, before I even worked for the ARRL. Alan was a section manager and I was an EC. So, I've known Alan a lot of years and you're right. And Bob, what a tremendously dedicated guy. Making sure product review we could talk about for a few minutes here, because product review is one of the most, if not the most, well-read features in QST. People really look to us to make sure that these products perform as represented. And Bob has really been instrumental in improving that process. Over the past couple of years, in fact, just maybe 2-3 weeks ago, we've been upgrading the entire test facility in the lab. We just got a new Keysight arbitrary waveform generator. Bob has found that some of the new equipment, like the receivers, are so good that we've had to upgrade the test equipment just to test them because their parameters exceeded that of our existing test equipment. And
now, Ted, is this a great lead-in for next week's show?
Absolutely.
Is Bob going to be on next week?
We have Bob and Rob Sherwood in tandem to discuss testing and just, you know, different perspectives and just how do you create metrics that are both scientifically meaningful and yet usable. You know, but Rob has the famous Sherwood table. So we will follow up on this next week in great detail, Harold.
From an editorial standpoint, though, we've increased the number of product reviews in QST based on our research and analytics that we get from the digital edition tell us that those are really – it's a really highly read part of QST. So we've increased our the number of product reviews that we're doing and trying to branch out a little more into some areas, more digital products. Sometimes we try to do more smaller products. We don't always have to do the big transceivers every month. Not everybody buys a new transceiver every month, but people buy a lot of other things that they're interested in having reviewed and tested by the lab. Another real important function of the lab that I think a lot of people don't realize is the representation that we get at national standards bodies and sanctioning bodies. It gives ARRL a seat at the table at these organizations. Ed Hare does a lot of that work where he's on a lot of IEEE committees. He's chairman of one of the RF committees. And, you know, today the noise environment just continues to increase. Unintentional emitter type noise. You know, switching power supplies and grow lights and everything else. And one of the important functions of the lab is to make sure that amateur radio's voice is heard at all these, not necessarily enforcement bodies, but standards bodies who write the standards for the industry on this kind of stuff. And I don't think most people are really aware that we do that kind of work.
Well, you know, I was going to say there's a lot. You know, one of the things that I found is a lot of stuff that goes on inside the league. The league does a lot of things that the average member doesn't know even goes on. And, of course, you know, it's not that it's hidden. It's just that there's such a myriad of things when it comes to amateur radio. And, you might want to mention a few of those things that right off the top of your head. And I know that's asking a lot because you're involved in so many things, and to try to target and remember, you know, it's like saying, okay, what was your phone number when you were 15 years old?
Yeah.
Things that folks that may not be aware of.
Well, I've written about 100+ Inside HQ columns trying to explain all this stuff. Well, in the lab, I can think by department. I don't know if everybody knows we have a technical information service, for example, that handles lots of calls. Lab engineers, even Bob, pick up the phone and talk to members about who have, may have a technical question, you know, ranging from how do I put up a dipole to the most complex technical questions, and we try and track them all down. The lab does the standards bodies work. It does the product review work. Let me think on another department in VEC. We administer thousands of exams a year. We also have to get all that stuff done, all the tests printed and distributed. We have to sanction all of the VEs. A department people may not be familiar with, now that I'm thinking about it, is our Education Services Department under the leadership of Deborah Johnson, K1DMJ. That department has a lot of functions. One function are the teachers' institutes, which we run. Last year, I think we ran four of them off the top of my head, where we bring in teachers from all over the country, tuition-free, and we teach them about wireless technology for about a week. Oh, last year, I'm just looking at my notes here. We have three sessions of the teachers' institutes with 32 teachers from 21 states. So we've now trained, I think, over 350, 400 teachers in wireless technology. Many of them end up getting their amateur radio license. Some of them have their amateur radio license when they come in. We run the ARIS program. That's Amateur Radio on the International Space Station program. Last year, we did about 35 contacts using schools to talk to the International Space Station. And that requires a lot of coordination with NASA, getting the orbits right. It requires getting the astronauts themselves licenses. So we have to do all that kind of work. The ARIS work is in coordination with NASA and with AMSAT, and with some of the European agencies and with the Japanese Amateur Radio League. That department also does a lot of license support. They just published a book for tech in general instructors' use, which probably wouldn't be done. It's other people publish license manuals, but we do one for instructors. We also register instructors. It's not highly qualified, but I think we have about 5,000 instructors,
including one on this podcast.
Okay, so we do that. We manage to somehow figure out who's what with about 3,200. Oh wait, I inverted the numbers. 2,300 ARRL clubs all over the country that we pay attention to who's in charge and who's what they're doing, and we provide some amount of programs for them. Certainly like to do a little more on that front. The other thing we do a lot of is through our website supply a lot of information if you need to find an exam session or if you need to find a club or if you want to contact an instructor. We do a lot of that. We do a lot of advocacy on behalf of amateur radio. Right now, Brennan Price, who is our chief technology officer, happens to be in Geneva. And if you've been following the story, we've been working on trying to get a new 5 megahertz allocation through the ITU. Another vote's going to come up on that tomorrow. But Brennan goes to lots of meetings with International Spectrum Body. And again, a lot of it is just making sure that there's a representative of amateur radio at the table who is knowledgeable and credible and has some integrity, who can make sure that we defend our frequencies and possibly pick up some new frequencies. On the U.S. legislative front, you probably know that we're now in the process of trying to get H.R. 1361 and the companion Senate bill through the House. We now have, I didn't check today, I think around 110 co-sponsors in the House and three senators. thank you, Frank. I know you were helpful in some of that down there with Senator Wicker from Mississippi.
I was the constituent, as they like to say in the office, who made the request. And it's my understanding that as early as tomorrow, that committee could be working on markup for 1681.
That's correct. So we all have our fingers crossed on that one. It's kind of ironic that the two co-sponsors are from Connecticut and Mississippi, the two states that we're both from, right?
You bet.
Senator Blumenthal up here in Connecticut is one of the other co-sponsors.
Well, we would like to think, a little chest pounding, but given that Wicker is chair of the subcommittee, which provides oversight for the FCC, there was probably no bigger 800-pound gorilla to get to offer that.
Yes. So thank you, Frank. So we do a lot of that. We also keep an eye on, through our lobbying firm, what's happening in the state legislatures as well. And the legislative liaisons get reports on what sort of bills come up in the state legislatures about amateur radio. We also get involved in – we also have a advisory service for engineers, and we have a legal advisory service, which is more like a brokerage where hams have volunteered, lawyers have volunteered who are hams, and engineers who are hams have volunteered, where if a member in a particular area – has a problem, they've volunteered to help, and we try and connect the two. Another big thing that we do, which is another thing that surprised me 10 years ago when I arrived, is the amount of pure processing for awards and contests that we do. It's just unbelievable when you start looking at it. I mean, there's how many people in Logbook of the World now? I think we have about 82,000 users in Logbook of the World. And I think I could pull up the webpage, but I think almost or around 750 million QSO records in that database.
And Harold, where is that hosted computer-wise? I mean, did you guys start out with a local server? But
yes, there was a local server in Newington, but not anymore.
Yeah. Have you gone to the cloud with it?
Yes.
Great.
I don't know which service.
Good. Smart move.
Yeah, and it's now redundant. It's always backed up like all of our data.
Yeah.
We've spent the last couple of years updating, for lack of a better word, the guts of Logbook of the World. Its uptime is now much improved. We published the uptime statistics on the Logbook of the World reflector. And the average is over 99% a month uptime now. We've had to update and expand the database. I mean, that's a big database to carry that many records. So that is a big job to keep running. That now has two full-time programmers on it and a number of volunteers who work on other parts of the software who are experts on the client side and stuff. So that is a gigantic database. We're going to start moving ahead a little more with it, fixing up the user interface. We concentrated for the last couple of years on getting the database stable, scalable, and operating really well, and improving the client side, which has been improved. The TQSL program's really been improved. And now we're going to start making some updates on the way it looks to the user. So that's next in the cards for that.
One of the things I'd like to do, and kind of pause here for just a second, and that is we get so many new hams that listen. They come up to us at Dayton and they say, hey, you know, thank heavens, you guys are responsible for us getting the license, you know, but now for the newbies that are out there. Why don't you explain what Logbook of the World is? I mean, I know that sounds maybe a little crazy to everybody that understands, but not everyone listening right now has a clue as to what you're even talking about. Talk about Logbook of the World.
Okay, that's a very valid point, Ted. And even experienced people, some people don't know what Logbook of the World is. But I'll do my best because it's a complicated concept, I guess. But about... I don't know, 15 years ago, before I arrived, it was just up and running when I got there. The league decided to start an online QSL confirmation system. Essentially, that's what Logbook of the World is. And essentially, if you and I have a QSO, you upload your record of the QSO, I upload my record of the QSO, and if they match time, date, frequency, call sign, etc., then we both get credit for that towards an operating award. So instead of having to send 100 cards in to get a DXCC award, I better explain what DXCC is. DXCC means confirming 100 countries. And we could even go deeper into that and explain what constitutes an entity. But for simplicity's sake, if you wanted that award or a Worked All States award where you contacted all 50 states, up until Logbook of the World, you needed to send the league 50 cardboard cards, one for each state. But with Logbook of the World, if I make contact with 50 amateurs in 50 states and all of us uploaded our information in the Logbook of the World and I came up with 50 confirmations, I would be given the award. Does that explain it well enough?
I think it does, but I guess I was interested in brand new hams that have just got licenses. You know, maybe they haven't even joined the league yet. They don't. Mm-hmm. They've maybe seen somebody else's QST. You know, maybe they have stolen one, you know, from some ham's house, you know. But
that would be fair use.
Yeah, okay. Now, the thing is, how do they get involved in that? How do they sign up for it? How do they begin? The beginning part of things is always the toughest part because people are afraid of things they don't know anything about. And yeah. I guess that's why I was saying, hey, tell us about this. But how does a brand new newbie get in here and say, hey, you know what, I want to get involved and you know, with Logbook of the World, and I want to make contacts and I want to get confirmations?
Wow, that's a big question. The first thing they would have to do essentially is have an HF station, be able to get on the HF frequencies from 80 meters through 10 meters, particularly for DXCC. Once they have an operating station, which is no easy trick. We all know, you know, getting a transceiver and putting up an antenna and integrating everything together and learning how to use it is not an easy thing to do. You got to be pretty smart and have some help generally to get all that put together to get on HF. But once you're there, you may decide that you would like to try a personal challenge of achieving an operating award. The most popular award in the world is the DXCC award, which is confirming essentially 100 countries. The next one is probably the Worked All States award. And these awards represent personal challenges. They're not contests. They signify a personal achievement, an amount of technical expertise and operating expertise and a commitment of time. So a new ham would get on, make some contacts. There are lots of ways to find DX or distance stations. You can look online. There are things called DX clusters that tell you what stations are on the air. You have to learn a little bit or a lot about how propagation works. You have to sometimes learn about different operating modes. You may not be able to get them all on voice. You may have to get some on digital modes. And once you start making these contacts, you can either hold them or you can load them into Logbook of the World. To get onto Logbook of the World, you need to download some software from our website. It's a very secure system. It's called the double blind system. We then send you some information that you have to enter, like a secret password. And we confirm that you're on and then you're up and running. Logbook of the World is entirely a web-based service, except for your own individual client that registers you. Many of the popular software logging programs, and I guess I'd have to say just about all of them, now have automatic upload to Logbook of the World and download from Logbook of the World. Last year, the ARL did the Centennial QSO party, and pretty much all the confirmations were done on Logbook of the World. You can still, of course, send the league paper cards and we count them towards award, or you can do combinations thereof. You could have 25 states on paper and 25 states in Logbook of the World, and we'd still be happy to issue you a Worked All States award. The whole subject is really complicated once you start getting into it. But I hope that's at least a helpful explanation.
Well, I think what you've done is you've given us an overview. And somebody that's just starting up new and they've just got done building their Heathkit Hot Water 101. And see, we woke Frank up when I said that. Anyways, they've put their HF station together. They're tuning around. You know, they hear all kinds of things. They're tuning past something. They hear CQ contest. What is that? What does that mean? What's going on here? You know. So Logbook of the World is something I'm sure that most folks that are oriented toward making multiple contacts and getting verifications. Now, see, when I was a novice, I never took any of that seriously. All I wanted to do was cover the walls of my room with QSL cards. That's all I knew. That was the only mile. I didn't care if they came from across the street or if they came from China.
Right.
As long as they took up space and they were colorful. So when people walked in, they said, wow, you've talked to all those people, you know?
Yeah.
So everyone has their own deal as to why they want to do, collect cards or make DX contests or contacts, I should say, or participating in contests. But sometimes it's a little evasive. So you've done a great job of explaining this, and I think that may have sparked some interest here on a bunch of folks that have tuned in and said, gee, I didn't know that. What do you think, Frank?
Well, you know, one of the things that this illustrates is how pluralistic we are. You know, we talked earlier about all the stuff that's now particular modes and types of operations. And yet we very often have these ham-fisted arguments about, you know, one activity or what have you. And some of the work that I had done for the Delta Division in surveying amateurs in those four states is very clear that the operating behaviors of DXers / contesters, although they're not always one and the same, versus experimentalists, people who like to build, and they may not get on the air except for testing that much, are very unique and very different from the MCOM group and others. And there are the rag chewers, people who just like to talk to people. So, you know, that contesting part is a little bit akin to those who jog versus those who do marathons. And I think in the culture of amateur radio, it would be nice if more of us kind of accepted that pluralism, that different people, different strokes for different folks, I guess. That's, Harold, what I would call as a social scientist, when we get too tied up into modeism, the mode, and Ted, write the word down, Ted. That's another word. He liked it when I mentioned pro-social interaction a few episodes ago, Harold.
Kay Craigie has sometimes said we want to avoid the balkanization of amateur radio.
Absolutely. Now, modism should not be confused with modism, because we all like to do mods on our equipment.
That's
so
right.
Let me make a distinction there. But the contesting bit, we have a group here in that's based largely out of South Mississippi called the 599 DX Group. And they are some of the best DXers in the world in terms of their career record. And it's the kind of thing that the longer they do it, the more they can be asleep at the wheel, but bingo, a cluster report, or they hear a call or what have you, and they already know all about that station. So it's like fly fishing to me, Harold. You got to study the craft.
Yeah.
And yet everybody throws that line out there, but the longer you do it, the more you learn.
Yeah, and there are a lot of branches to that even. I mean, you get to learn a lot about geography and islands and esoteric places you've never heard of. And sometimes you even have the opportunity to visit them, to learn about other cultures. I mean, sitting at the league, I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of people from many of these lands that I would never, ever meet.
Well, or that's part of the beauty, I think, of amateur radio is that ability to talk to people. When I was over in Atlanta, and it's as trivial as far as the difficulty of it, but I absolutely loved it. Using EchoLink with a local repeater with an HT as I would come from my parking lot to the Board of Regents office at the Capitol, I had a QSO almost every morning with a guy from England, and he was, you know, in his early 20s. And we would just talk, and it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. I've had a friend that I talk to all the time in Canada, in Nova Scotia, that I met on CW 30 years ago. And we've talked almost every week for 30 years.
Now, Harold, you have in your QRZ page and in your own personal website, and Ted, you may be aware of this as well. Harold loves CW and keys.
Yes.
And that is the kind telegraph of a craft. Keys. At telegraph keys, particularly.
I was once introduced at a thing, and I think I was at a cable conference, and somebody got up and said he collects keys. And a whole bunch of people came up to me and asked me about all these skeleton keys, dead bolts and everything.
Tell us a little bit about that in your collection. I mean, what attracts you to that?
Well, I started years and years ago as sort of a casual collector because I always went to a lot of ham fests. And keys were inexpensive and easy to carry, and they always kind of fascinated me. I've always been kind of a CW operator. Oh, well, lately I've been on a lot of digital modes, but I'm still kind of a CW operator at heart. And you know, they were the first way to move information faster than a horse or a locomotive. You know, when you think about it, the telegraph was a startling invention because before that, if you had to move a message, say, from where I'm sitting in Connecticut to where you are in Mississippi, Frank, it would have taken a week or more to get it there. Weeks, maybe. But when the telegraph came around, it could be done very quickly, even using relay stations, a couple of hours. So it was really, I hate to use the cliched word, but the telegraph was a transformative technology.
Well, it was, and if the Transcontinental Railroad, you know, was a precursor to that,
yes,
that was like the Transcontinental Railroad as far as movement of information flow on steroids.
Yes, and it opened the era where mankind learned that you could move information using electricity. Once a telegraph, which is really just a key, is really a single pole, single throw switch. With, you know, we all know how it works. It pulses on and off CW. But once we figured out that, then we learned how to send voice, and we learned how to send picture, and now we've learned how to send data, just like we're doing as we talk right now. So the telegraph key has always fascinated me, and there are so many variations on what would appear to be a very simple device. A single pull, single throw switch. Everything from toy keys. I wrote an article in QST about toy keys. I got an incredible response from people who had, you know, Boy Scout keys when they were kids. So kids used to grow up with these devices. To training keys in the military, like J-38 keys, J-37 keys. To spy keys for the military. To commercial telegraphy, special keys for spark transmitters, spy keys. It's a whole other story about telegraphy. I've actually given a lot of talks at local clubs, fairly local, within the New England, New York region. If I'm invited and I'll bring out 15 or 20 keys with me and talk about the history of telegraphy and the telegraph key. So it's something I've just always kind of interested in. And I have to admit, working for the league, I get to go to a lot of ham fests all over the country, and I've sort of – the same principle that I talked about in the beginning applies. Telegraph keys are small. You can put them in your suitcase. Unless a TSA thinks it's something else, you're usually pretty good, you know. They don't always know what to make of a bug. You know, Viraplex looks like something else to them sometimes. But other than that, things usually work out okay.
You know, one of the most fascinating radio programs, and we must do a, let's see here, what time is it? Nope, we're not overdue yet. One of the most fascinating programs I have done, and Harold, you've got to be familiar with these people, is a group called the Morse Telegraph Club.
Sure, I'm a member.
Okay, well, yeah, well, these guys, and you may want to tell, they have their own separate network apart from amateur radio. You could might talk about that, but that was the most fascinating thing. I never dreamed something like that existed.
Yeah, I've never used it, but I've seen it in action, and it uses telegraph sounders, not electronic tones. So, you know, the before electronic oscillators were built, CW used a mechanical sounder, a magnet essentially pulled down a bar, you know, and went, right. I could reach over here and get one and make it click for you. Hold on. All right, let's see if we can get some actual audio here. Can you hear that?
Yes.
That's the way CW used to sound. I'm clicking one of the sounders in my collection. And that's
on Gunsmoke.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strictly electromechanical. And that's what they send through. You're right, Ted. That's what they send through the internet. They give you a little circuit board and somehow connects out a USB connection or something and hooks up to a sounder. I was just using one of the sounders in my collection. This was what you heard was a Western Electric sounder. So, and what I learned is when they were actually used in the offices, the metal bar was always held down by the magnet. That was the normal state because that way you knew the line was working and current was flowing. And if you heard a snap like that, it means something broke in the line, which is pretty cool.
Frank, think about this. These guys are connecting these sounders up through USB on computers and then talking back and forth as if they actually had a pair of wires crossing the country. And they're totally 100% just, you know, their breath has been taken away by Morse code and CW. And in addition to that, the gentleman I talked to, I wish I could remember his name, so they're using not just the standard Morse code, but they're using, what is it, the American?
Yeah, we use the international now, but originally the American Morse code was used.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember the president's name here. Jim Wade's, maybe?
That sounds right. That sounds right, yep.
Yeah.
But he was talking about that they were using the other code and the regular Morse code, and most of those fellows could switch back and forth in their head without any trouble at all. And I thought,
not me.
I was going to say, I couldn't keep up with that at all.
No, I couldn't either. It's funny, in that article I was talking to you about where I wrote about the toy keys, almost all toy keys have the code on the key, either pressed into the plastic or there's a little metal plate attached. Because if you have a toy key, you're supposed to learn the Morse code, and you have to have your own little cheat sheet in front of you. And I didn't realize it, but a couple of the ones I had photographed for the article had the American Morse code and not the international Morse code on it. And I had a whole bunch of people write me emails, send me emails saying, how come it's the wrong code on that key? Because it's a little different. The numbers in particular are different, I think.
You know, it was really strange, too, when we had a booth and we were right next to Vibraplex at one point in time, excuse me, and it was right after the rules had changed, and maybe a year or two had gone by or something like that, and those fellows were sitting there, and they were right next to us in the booth, and I struck up a conversation, and they said to me, well, you know what, we're selling more product now than we did when the code was a requirement. And I also had talked to several fellows that were publishing code practice CDs and, mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. And they all were saying the same thing. They were saying, yeah, oh, man, we're busy now. You know, a lot busier than we used to be. Go ahead.
We have not seen any reduction in the amount of logs submitted for CW contests that we run. or a reduction in any CW award submissions. If anything, like you were just citing, we've seen a little bit of pickup in it.
And that's amazing. That really is. And, folks used to use the code, I think, as an excuse. I just can't learn that code, And I would sit down and I would just pound out like five characters, and just keep switching them back and forth. And they got to the point where they identified all of them. I said, well, do you realize that you've only got like four more groups to go and you're done? You can pass the test. And you may not be able to be fluent with it, but four more groups. But it's really strange because the other thing I found that once people started playing with it, so many of them then became obsessed with CW. It just became a total, they just loved it, And the folks that were into phone, they'd look at them like, well, we don't know.
Yeah.
Can't figure this out.
For stations like mine that have wire antennas and, don't run a kilowatt and a half, it's a much more efficient mode.
Oh, yeah. No question about that. No question about that, because it doesn't take. But what's, it's really funny now is both of my sons have general class licenses, and we got into a discussion here. It's been a couple years ago, but anyways, and I happened to mention a BFO, a beat frequency oscillator.
The oscillator, right.
And they both gave me a blank look, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Modern radio just pushed the button, it says CW, and does all the work.
Let me do this then, and goodness, Frank, jump in. Don't let me monopolize things here, because you know how I am. I'll do that. Let's talk for just a moment about ARRL membership. And the reason why I bring this up is because of the fact that I think that a lot of folks don't realize, there's a lot of new hams coming into the circle.
Yes.
There's a lot of hams that have never renewed their memberships that should. But when you consider everything that's involved in league membership and you look at the dollar sign next to it, it's almost crazy when you think about it. In other words, you get a subscription to the QST magazine, obviously. But then you've got QST Online that goes all the way back to Methuselah, the very, very first QST that you can go in and look up all these different articles. You could read for days, months, years, reading articles written all the way back into the tube technology and all that sort of thing. Talk about league membership, because I think this is important. This is something that folks need to be on board with.
Yeah. There's a couple of different perspectives here. I think you're asking me to speak about the benefits of league membership as opposed to how league membership is doing. I can speak on either one.
I guess I was more thinking in terms of not the benefits of league membership in terms of like a person, well, what do I get out of this?
Yeah.
The reasons why it's a good thing, other than what you get out of it.
Oh.
What is it that by league membership that you're contributing to the hobby as well?
Yeah, well, you're contributing to a lot of things I spoke about earlier. The international representation of amateur radio is very important. The microwave and other frequencies are worth lots and lots of money these days. And unless someone is there talking about amateur radio and talking about the value of amateur radio to their community and to their nation, those frequencies will go away at some point. So the ARRL sits at that table, and not just sits there, but is an active advocate. The same thing is true of legislation in Washington. We have a lobbying firm in Washington. It monitors what goes on in Congress all the time. And if anything of importance to amateur radio comes up, they let us know. And we have become more proactive with the introduction of our own legislation that we have out now on HOAs, on homeowner association, trying to eliminate those restrictions. We're actively representing amateur radio with the FCC and other regulatory agencies. As I said earlier, we represent amateur radio at the standard body of professional associations. So there's an awful lot of what I would call universal benefits that, you're right, Ted, an individual member gets their issue of QST every month, or they look at it on their iPad. But the other benefits to ARL membership are the representation and the advocacy of amateur radio. And that also includes advocacy and representation in the public service arena. Last year, we signed a new agreement with FEMA. We had Ted Fugate, the head of FEMA, who's a ham, speak at the Centennial Convention. And we provide representation for amateur radio groups all over the country at a national level with many public service groups and with many educational groups and with NASA and so forth. So those would be the things that the ARRL does that an individual member doesn't always know or doing or doesn't see. But it's that representation and advocacy of amateur radio that's important for us to survive long term in the future.
So like a club affiliation, you know, if a local area, an area, a bunch of guys get together and say, hey, we're going to make us a ham radio club here. We're going to join hands and make an organization. So once they form their organization, then they can affiliate with the ARRL.
Yes.
And that gives them an almost endless supply of ideas and resources that they just wouldn't have otherwise.
That's correct. And it gives them exposure via our website to other people in their area who may be trying to find them, who wouldn't know that they existed, because clubs usually don't have phone numbers and some of them don't have addresses per se, maybe a post office box. But we do act, like I said earlier, as sort of a brokerage capacity where I want to take a test. How do I find one? I go to the ARRL website. There's a list of all the exam sessions. I want to find a local club. How do I do that? I go to the ARRL website and I look up on their Club Finder service. So we provide a lot of that aggregation of data and give our members and other people in the amateur radio community and who are not in the amateur radio community the ability to find that data and connect locally. Our research tells us, Frank, you're the sociologist here, but our research tells us that most people become hams by pretty much direct connection with other hams, friend and family members. They don't just come from, a few must, but they don't generally come just out of the blue. So that's a lot of the stuff that we try to do. There's just so much of it. I've probably left something or other out.
It's a tremendous thing that probably flies under the radar, except for the most astute readers of the website and QST. Things like, for example, Ted, the grow lights that have come on the market at your standard big box stores like Lowe's or Home Depot, and they are terrible RFI generators. And I think the league was probably the first group in the country to identify that and advocate for regulation. Is that fair, Harold?
Yes, absolutely.
And so, you know, there's just a lot of things like that that might just be a minor blip on the average ham's radar, and they don't appreciate that. One thing that Harold is saying in this larger picture is that whether you're a dues-paying member or not, they do things for you as a ham. And, you know, we all have what's sometimes called the free rider syndrome where, well, I don't really have to be a member. You know, other people are, and they can pay the freight. Well, that's a little bit like, you know, Salvation Army rings the kettle during the holiday season. Why? But they get money from elsewhere, but they kind of have to have money to do other things as well. So the league is, in a sense, as a 501c3 nonprofit, the money does have to come from somewhere. And that's sort of the commonality of experience. I late in life ham, I went ahead and paid the freight and was elected to life membership because I wanted to be part of the organization. And unless I do something contumacious, Harold, you can't get rid of me.
Okay. I'm a life member too. You know, the other thing I really haven't talked about too much is our publications business. We provide about 150 titles now. I mean, we don't publish them all at once. obviously. But we provide lots and lots and lots of published information to our members and to other people. Not all of it is printed anymore. We now have we're probably coming up on 15, 20 publications that are strictly that have been converted from print to ebook now, which is an interesting phenomenon. It's expanded our market. There are people all over the world who can go on Amazon and download the Ham Radio License Manual in Kindle version. I was just looking at it, and I think it's our bestseller on Amazon, and it opens up a worldwide market. But there's some downsides in that we don't develop any direct relationship with the person buying the book, and the person buying the book does not develop any direct relationship with some of the other amateur radio retailers who they're going to have to purchase a rig from. So kind of a double-edged sword. But we do publish lots of books, you know, things like the handbook, which are used beyond amateur radio, and other publications like the repeater directory, the operating manual, lots of technical books. The most popular books that the Aero publishes are anything with the word antenna in the title. Usually is a good selling book, because probably it's one of the few things that we can actually do ourselves these days. So we do have a publication suite of products that is something else we do. You don't have to be a member to buy many of them. And we also, besides QST, publish two other print magazines. One is called QEX, which is highly technical, very advanced experimental radio science and technology, which is a good thing. And the other one is called NCJ, which is National Contest Journal, that talks about both beginning and advanced techniques for contesters. So we do a lot on the publications front. We publish the ARL letter every week. It goes out to over 100,000 members, plus gets published on QRZ. And we have a bunch of other newsletters, the Aries e-newsletter and the contest update and radio waves for educators. So we pump out a lot of content about amateur radio.
Let me ask you as a follow-up to that. Of course, I'm in the publishing business as an editor with a large scientific publisher.
Sure.
When you know, you're basically a publishing house, in addition to all the other things
right.
that you do, and you
right.
just talked about the revolution in ebooks. I recently bought the book on oscilloscopes on my iPad, and I enjoy a lot of that. The downside is that, you know, like we do with a lot of books, hey, can I borrow your copy of? And you know that I will say, as someone who has books that have gone out and have not come back, I kind of like them electronically, because I'd be a fool to loan my iPad to someone else, since I live with it so much. Now, on your stuff that you pump out, as you mentioned, a lot of people don't have a real world understanding of intellectual property. That is, when someone publishes something in QST or a book with you, who owns the copyright to that?
The ARRL owns the copyright.
And see, a lot of people don't realize that is the standard thing in any public. When you think about it, people often think in the commercial world that an author, like, say, my former neighbor here in Mississippi, John Grisham, his book costs $25 and he must get about 20 of it. Well, it's usually the opposite. I mean, 10% royalty fee is a pretty good, pretty standard fee. And if you're someone like John Grisham now, your agent may negotiate that a little bit upward. You make your money on the movie rights and the other things. To what extent do you have intellectual property issues with ARRL publications? That is, people who, whether they realize it or not, they're giving copies away, and it, you know, wouldn't be really the thing to do, or they're reselling them or something like that. Have you run into much of that kind of thing?
Hold that thought just for 1 second. This is Radio Station WTWW. Lebanon, Tennessee, United States of America, and this is QSO Live. Go ahead.
Okay. We have not had that much difficulty with that, to be honest with you. First of all, our books, we try to keep the price pretty reasonable. So if someone wants to purchase one, I mean, you're in academia and you know how much those textbooks cost. They're way up there.
I did teach statistics. And so, you know, that typesetting and making sure those formulas are correct, that really adds even more.
Yeah. The highly technical content that we publish is complicated to get right with graphs and charts. Even a product review has a lot of photography in it that we get the radios professionally photographed. We have all the charts and graphs that Bob comes up on the numbers. We have an art and production department with a CAD CAM artist, Dave Pingree, who does a lot of the charts and the graphs. So it's not just straight text that needs to be published. We do occasionally get people who duplicate the CDs that come with the books and try to sell them independently. A lot of that's gone away recently because CDs have kind of gone out of favor. We used to put more CDs in the books with information, but not so much anymore since it can be downloaded on the web or in other forms. So we have not had a big intellectual property problem with ARL publications, at least not to my knowledge. I mean, you know, it could be going on and we don't know about it. But I haven't seen too much of that.
I will see them sometimes on the infamous torrent sites and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, to some degree, there's a margin of where it would cost you more to enforce it than it would be relative to what you lost, so to speak. And a lot of people, you know, people who steal, well, they realize they're not, sometimes would not be a customer anyway. They either get it free or they don't get it. You know, that's one thing that people don't realize, and whether it's, you know, another type of organization or not, you have to make a profit. You have to have a revenue stream coming in to fund these other things that the league does. And so you'll hear people who, you know, hams are cheap, right? News breaking story, Ted, hams are cheap. And so often you'll see complaints, you know, about the price of anything. Yet the need to respect the fact that you have to make a profit on that, even though you're a non-profit organization,
right?
Because that helps fund other things. I want to shift a little bit just because you've been talking about all these things that the league does. And one could easily imagine that hamster on a wheel, that group of hamsters on a wheel. And the problem with those hamsters is that they never get where they're going, or they don't know where they're going because they're going around and around. Well, the league has a strategic planning process to try to vision where the league should go in the future and make some determinations about it. You are on that particular task force.
Yep.
Could you talk about what it is and how it's going and kind of what some of the thinking is?
Sure. First of all, I do have to say that when you get this month's QST in the mail, which should be any day now, depending on how the post office gets them out, or the digital edition is already out, there is an update on the strategic plan in my Inside HQ column on page 13. So, essentially, the board in January 2014, I think it was. I may not have that right because we've been going at this a while. Maybe it was July. Authorized, maybe it was January 2015.
January 2015. I think the last was in 2009.
Yeah. In January 2015, they put together a strategic planning committee. Jim Fenstermaker, who is the K9JF, who is the second vice president, formerly the director of the Northwest Division, was chosen as its chairman because Jim had a lot of professional experience with strategic planning. The other folks in the group are Greg Wyden, Greg is the division director in the Dakota division, and had a also everybody on the committee had some sort of background in strategic planning. Greg had worked in his career at 3M, I believe, doing that. Bonnie Altus, who is the vice director from Oregon, is a member of the committee. Kermit Carlson, who is the vice director in the Central Division, is on the committee. Kermit is W9XA, and Kermit has had experience. Let's see, who did I miss? Bonnie, Kermit, Art Ziegelbaum, the vice director from Nebraska, who's another academic. He's a professor at the University of Nebraska, is on the committee. And Bob Inderbitson, also like me from headquarters, NQ1R, is on the committee. We actually call it the Strategic Planning Working Group.
And there's some lady from Blacksburg, Virginia on it, too.
Kay is not on it.
Okay. She simply tasked Fenstermaker. I'm with you.
Although the president, I believe, is ex officio on any board committee if she wants to sit through it. So we started working on the plan. We're trying to do a five-year version of the plan. We've gone through about 11 months. We did a presentation at the July board meeting on the first parts of it. It's similar to every other strategic planning process. I've been through a few in my career where you first develop a mission statement and then a vision statement and then a value statement and then a bunch of goals or initiative underneath that. The trick is to try and figure out where the organization is going in the future. That gets more and more difficult to do. We're looking at a five-year plan. I think we've made some really excellent progress. Another thing we did this time, which was not done, is we've gathered input from lots of other groups. We did a very, we had an outside firm, Redex. You might be familiar with them, Frank. They did a survey of a statistically valid survey. I can't vouch for that, but that's what they say, and that's their business. A statistically valid survey of a couple of thousand members and non-members, and we got a lot of information from that. We did a survey of the section managers. We surveyed our advertisers. We've talked it up at many of the conventions. We've just got all kinds of input back from all of these various stakeholders that we've tried to integrate into the plan about where amateur radio and the ARRL in particular is going to be going during the next 5 years and what we think its vision is going to be. Does that help you out?
It does. How transparent will that input be as far as the membership? You're going to have a report and those kind of things, but will any of those data or numbers be available to members?
I don't think so. I think the Redex survey is kind of proprietary information, although we've cited a few things from it here and there. We do plan to share all of the mission statement, the vision statement, which we put in QST in the December issue already for everybody to read. And they published it previously in well, I did an update a couple of months ago in QST and got some more feedback on it. So we're going to publish mission, vision, and I think we're going to publish the key initiatives. But some of it will not be because it's almost sort of proprietary information to the organization.
Uh-huh.
That would be somewhat detrimental if it got let out. But it'll be as transparent as we can make it.
Now, did they call Ted and me any ugly names in that survey? Is that why you're not going to let it out?
No, I didn't hear anything about that.
Then we haven't been doing our job.
But that's right. We haven't been doing our job.
I've got a question, and I kind of like to shift gears just a little bit here. And understand, Harold, I'm not trying to put you on a hot seat. I'm just trying to grasp, I guess I want to say, an opinion. And some of this might be personal opinion, and then you may also be speaking on behalf of the league, I really don't know. But it's just something that has struck me strange, and that is this. As early as last night, I had turned on a rig. My son David has taken and put a wire up outside my bedroom. And so now I have an Elenco DX70 there with the EDX2 tuner. So, you know, I can do a little damage at night. You know, if I can't sleep, I can push the button and listen. And I happened on a frequency. It was 3843. And these fellows were talking. And, I mean, they really sounded like a group of nice guys. And I'm listening for a few minutes. And then all of a sudden, the language just turned absolutely blue. If there had been kids in the room, I would have been ushering them out the door and closing the door. Now, not that I'm a prude, and not that I am, I don't know what the term would be, a little too straight laced or something. I mean, I realize that language on television is somewhat compromised. I think it is, but I've noticed this all over the 75 meter band. I mean, you're sitting there listening to somebody talking. And, I mean, it's like they sound like they're nice folks, and they sound like somebody you might want to, you know, sit down and have a cup of coffee with. And all of a sudden, here comes multiple F-bombs out of their mouth over the air, and it just leaves me scratching my head, and I'm saying, wait a minute, man. I mean, is this all this hobby means to you? And I mean, I don't know. I mean, are we looking at something? Is this illegal? Is it legal? Is it legal but just in bad taste? You know, and I mean, it just leaves me scratching my head. I'm thinking, where is this going and why? Why is this happening? And people can say society and all that, but I would like to think that amateur radio guys are a cut above all that. So how does this strike you, or what, even the league, as far as how, what is their position on it, or are they like I am, scratching their head trying to figure out?
You know, I think it's an embarrassment to amateur radio and a disgrace. And we all hear it. I think we've had a lot of meetings. Well, we've had some meetings with the FCC. In fact, Dave is down there tomorrow. My boss, Dave Sumner, K1ZZ, is down there tomorrow talking to him about a few things. I think we are scratching our heads, Ted. I don't think anybody has a magic solution on it. It's not so. It's like I said. It's disgraceful, I think, but it's not so egregious as to get the FCC always involved. You know, it's not malicious interference. It is against. I think it's. I'm not a lawyer. I think it's against the regulations. And it's certainly against the spirit of amateur radio, which essentially is a self-policing avocation. I have been at board meetings of the era where these kinds of activities have been discussed extensively. And if you look at the notes for the minutes for the July meeting, you'll see that the board has decided to step up the ARL's involvement in enforcement of these things. Not that they have a magic solution, but they're going to be exploring other options.
You know,
you're right. A kid listening at night. All of us, when we were younger, you know, listened to hams generally on AM, right, and other things, and. You said, wow, this is exemplary behavior, what these guys are doing, but it doesn't always follow suit. I hope these people are in the minority of amateur radio operators. Most of us try to adhere to very good operating standards and operating etiquette. But I guess there's always a few rotten apples in the barrel.
Well, what worries me, though, is you'll hear someone that will jump on the frequency and in a as kind a way possible, they'll say, "Do you have to use those superlatives on here? Can't we chill a little bit here? And you know, we got kids listening and all that." And then all of a sudden, the person on the air that was hurling the superlatives, he'll just hurl right back some more. Yeah. You know, you just shut up, go away, hit the road, all this stuff. You know, yeah. and. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't solve the problem. I wouldn't even know where to start. I guess the one of the things that we could do, but then that could turn into a nightmare. I would just start writing these guys' call signs down, and get a recording of them and publish it. Say, here's so and so. He doesn't know how to talk on the radio, so let's just don't talk to him. until he learns some manners. But even that, is kind of a.
Yeah. Empower them even more.
Official observers. Okay, official observers. It used to be when I was a kid. I remember getting a card from a official observer because I had a key click or a chirp or I had a harmonic or something. And you respected these people because they were volunteering their time to try to help prevent you from getting the real deal from one of the monitoring stations.
Yeah,
Yeah. And today I notice that that there's this almost cynical attitude toward official observers. And I'm thinking, these are guys just like me and you that have said, hey, I want to help the hobby. I want to be here and try to see, if I can help some guy that's got some sort of a technical problem or somebody accidentally happens to turn a radio on and they're outside of the band, I don't know. I'm wondering, is it futile to at the ages of the people we're dealing with, is it futile to try to teach the importance of respect and for the a little bit of reverence for the hobby, a little elevation of the value of the hobby? Are we too old for that? Are we past that learning stage, or do you think that some of these folks' thinking could be turned around a bit?
I don't know. I don't think anyone gets past learning. I mean, I think you can always learn something. That's part of the culture of amateur radio. I think amateur radio is a lifelong learning pursuit. I think amateur radio, to a small extent, mirrors other societal trends. As you said in the beginning, Ted, we've seen a deterioration of that in other media, where language that we would never hear coming out of broadcast radio or television is now coming out of broadcast radio and television. And I don't know that much about sociology. I'd have to defer to Frank on that one. Maybe he can comment about, is this a societal trend?
Well, part of it, bad? And I don't think anyone knows the complete answer. If so, we'd have better policing in general, or we'd have better, other kinds of things. But I do think there are a couple of forces. It's no secret that the FCC has sort of, amateur radio is not the top priority of the Fed.
If I could just butt in for a second, the same thing has happened with broadcast enforcement.
Well, and see, because the broadband revolution has captured a lot of that space. And beginning with the Reagan administration, when, as you very well know, Harold, when a lot of those things, a lot of those rules about markets and definitions changed. So part of the thing is that there's a lack of respect for any deterrent force. Now, some time ago, the FCC was listening. I had a cousin who worked at a place called Powder Springs, Georgia. It was not known for much of anything at the time. It's not too far outside of Atlanta. And back in South Georgia, back when there was a governor named Lester Maddox, who was known for a lot of negative things involving race relations and axe handles, one of the things that Governor Maddox did in Georgia was he put up a billboard sign near the South Georgia town called Ludowice, Georgia, because they were operating a new radar-based system as a speed trap. And so a lot of the people were coming to Florida from Connecticut down I-95 or from wherever. And he basically said, bypass Ludowice, don't stop. This cousin of mine went through Ludowice. He was actually one of those people who would be normally in a little white van that had a thin red stripe and small FCC letters. And he had a little loop antenna and some direction finding equipment. But he was traveling through Ludowice and got caught. He didn't think he was speeding, but he got caught. And they wanted him to pay a fair amount of money. So he said, well, I don't have it. And so they put him in the pokey overnight. And when he got out, he had his wife wire some money to him. And when he got out the next day, he paid his fine. He then showed them his credentials and asked for their license for the radar system. Oops, we don't have one. He impounded two cars of theirs, their radar equipment. They begged him to let's rescind the ticket and give you your money back. Boy, what sweet revenge was that was for him. Well, you kind of sort of don't have a lot of that anymore. You don't have the money for it. So I think there's the image that the man, if you will, is not out there listening. However, you've got all kinds of things from the kinds of language that Ted was talking about to the simple malicious interference. You know, if I said 14.313, you know, we've got an international issue where it's not just the ARL advocating to the U.S. enforcement agency. You've got to get the State Department in the U.S. and in Canada involved. Well, that's kind of small potatoes of somebody with a ham radio transmitter. I mean, in that sense of things. What I'm hearing that is music to my ears, Harold, is the official observer program getting a little higher priority with the league. We've got capability now to triangulate signals. And it's not just the lazy person that doesn't have an auto-tuned amp anymore or, they're tuning up to check into a net and they're just too lazy to get off a few kilohertz and not tune up on someone. It's those who are malicious and, as Ted said, hey, I got kids here. Well, they may not do the blue language, but then when Ted gets on for his part of the round table, nobody can hear him because they're just keying down. So I am totally, totally a fanboy for the league putting a little more oomph into the official observer program with some direction-finding capabilities. And with our technology to record, you get that voice graph with somebody with the FCC and the ability to drop the financial hammer on them. There's no denying that not only was it their transmitter, it was their voice. So I am an encouragement. You know, here's even a thought. I suspect you get people to actually donate to that fund to help support cleaning up, particularly HF, and putting a few more dollars into the official observer program. Now, you had a member tell you to raise more money, Harold.
Okay. I've got to pass that on to our development department.
Because I think that, you know, cleaning up the park, if you will, the anti-litter campaign does pass muster with a lot of people.
Yeah. I think the board directive was more than just OO, though, Frank. I think it also was to work with the regulatory agencies on additional enforcement. But like you said, the funding has been so cut back. I mean, we just saw the chairman of the FCC want to cut out a lot of field offices. You remember?
Absolutely. Doing it for them, though, Harold, is my point. Giving them the evidence is a little like it's a little like the do not call list.
Yep.
I've had a couple of those cases where I filed it, and they want your phone. And you, if you get that stuff and reduce their staff time, it runs through a whole lot faster. Ted?
You're right.
I think increasing the OO program is a great idea. I think it would definitely serve a purpose, and I think it could call attention to gross problems. However, I don't think you're going to see the offenders honor anything from an OO. I think, if anything, they scoff and they mock at people who are even in the position of being an OO. Now, there's some sort of factor there like that. So I agree with Harold. There's going to have to be some teeth to it. If they do it, there's going to have to be you know, a little sting of some kind, you know, in order for the
person. And Ted, I think you authored that sting previously. It's the old social control mechanism of ostracism. Let's say K4FMH is one of those culprits. Well, then, Harold, when your OOs have tangible evidence that K4FMH or WB8PUM are doing stuff that just ain't cool, then suddenly they're no longer eligible for awards, for legitimate contesting, for the kind of, you know, the kind of fruit that they want to pick off the tree. Now, that would be my counter argument, Ted, and that may not do as much. Now, another thing is enhancing what you do with clubs. Now, my argument as a sociologist, if you look at our organization, you know, ARL kind of has an official structure from Newington all the way down to the section, most of which are states, but some big states have multiple sections within them. But it kind of stops there. You kind of have an official affiliated club, a special service club, et cetera. But those clubs are kind of free agents too.
Yes, and they're not like the chapter model of the Red Cross.
To the extent that some oomph can be put in, and it's also up to the section manager. And let's just say that not every section manager looks at club liaison as a top priority. Well, you know, everything can't be a top priority, or nothing would be a top priority. So I respect that. However, those clubs are perhaps the closest group to those hams. Now, the downside is some of these people aren't group affiliated anyway, but people in their community, the local community, know who they are. So Ted articulated it, in my humble opinion, it's that ostracism sting that will be our best shot at moving the cheese of some of those offenders. If you can't, the lone wolf offender, the FCC is going to have to have the tools to go after. Anyway, Ted, that's my two cents on that. And
You know what? I hate to say this, but we are out of time. And that's the part I hate the most about doing this radio show. Harold, I want to say thank you so much for coming on and for talking with us and sharing. You know what? We could go another 2 hours here. Of course, you'd probably go to sleep. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's getting a little close to my bedtime here on the East Coast, but it's been a very enjoyable conversation, and it's brought up a lot of real substantive issues. So I appreciate you inviting me on.
I was going to say, if you have any closing remarks, anything that you'd like to talk about quickly, because we are out of time. Please, the floor is yours, sir.
Well, I've talked about an awful lot of topics, and I guess I would say that, you know, it's been my pleasure to be here, talk about some of these issues. Some of them, there's no easy answers. I wish there were. I hope I've given your listeners an overview of some of the activities that the league is doing for them that they may or may not be aware of. And I think that we're going to be on a pretty solid ground for the future, based on my work with the Strategic Planning Committee and trying to envision and implement what amateur radio is going to be in the next 5 years.
And Frank, any closing remarks, sir?
Harold, two things. Thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
And number two, retirement ain't half bad.
Okay, good. But you retired and you're still working.
Well, you know, I do it on my schedule and because I want to. Yeah. And my deal is, when I don't want to anymore, sayonara.
Yeah, I'm still going to be writing for QST. So I'm still going to be affiliated with the league after I retire.
That's a good transition.
Yeah.
Well, folks, once again, our guest tonight has been Harold Kramer, WJ1B. And I just want to thank him so very much for joining us tonight. Our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH. And we want to invite you again back next week, same time, same station, and wherever else that you may be listening, for another QSO Live. So with that, I say 73s and good night. Well, that's all the time we've got today for QSO. We want to say a special thank you to our guest today. Harold Kramer, the COO of the American Radio Relay League, WJ1B, and our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH. This is Ted Randall, WBHPUM, saying 73s. Join us again next week, same time, same station, same podcast, or wherever you happen to be listening.